One of the more audacious novels I've come across recently is by the Australian writer Elliot Perlman. The book's called Seven Types of Ambiguity. It's a story of obsessive love told by seven different narrators. The book raises a basic question. Can we ever know the truth when everyone has a different way of telling the same story? Here's one of those narrators trying to size up Simon, the novel's main character.
He was thinking of writing something on the work of his hero, the literary critic William Empson. You might remember Simon going on about Empson, the author of Seven Types of Ambiguity. But it's all lost on me. He bought me a copy. To put it simply, or perhaps simplistically, it seemed to be an analysis of the effects a poet may achieve, consciously or not, through the use of ambiguity. I couldn't get through the book. I suspect Simon knows this. As far as I was concerned, there were more important ambiguities than the ambiguity of poetic language that Empson talked about. There's the ambiguity of human relationships, for instance. A relationship between two people, just like a sequence of words, is ambiguous if it is open to different interpretations. And if two people do have differing views about their relationship, I don't just mean about its state, I mean about its very nature, then that difference can affect the entire course of their lives.
Elliot Perlman, reading from his book Seven Types of Ambiguity. Perlman says the idea for the novel came from his other career.
I'm a lawyer, a trial attorney, a barrister in Australia. But before I was, I was already a lawyer, but I was clerking for a Supreme Court judge, and we would listen to murder trials. And it struck me that frequently, you know, you'll see on television on a program like Law and Order, the outcome is determined with a great degree of certainty through DNA evidence, a blood sample, a fingerprint, something like that. But frequently, in my experience of criminal law in Australia, and I suspect it's the same everywhere, the verdict is determined by a jury based upon their collective assessment of different relationships. And you're asking 12 people to determine whether or not they think a certain event happened. You know, most crimes of violence actually happen between people that know each other. And so the relationship between the two people is extremely important to determine whether or not jurors think it's likely that a certain violent event was intended.
Well, I was curious about this because what you're saying is that we make judgments based upon the stories we hear.
Absolutely, yeah. And not only that, something that occurred to me as well in practicing law is that there is a tendency for most people to think that the first version of a story is the correct one. But it means this: there's always a bias in favor of the prosecution, because the prosecution presents its case first, and that's not a flaw in the system. It has to be that way. I mean, in order to answer a charge, someone has to lay the charge, make the accusation. And what it means is that when the jury hears a different account, say the defense account of the crime, they're already thinking, that doesn't sound right to me because I've already heard this story before. And this version slightly different from the previous version, so it must be wrong.
Yeah, we should get at the story that you tell in Seven Types of Ambiguity, because I'd give you the chance, I guess, to tell us the story first so that we can make any judgments based on on how true that is. It's a story with seven narrators, and there is there is a crime at the root of the stories that are told, right?
Look, there definitely is a crime, but what I've tried to do is make it so that the person that commits the crime, and he's a character named Simon, is very sympathetic and largely morally innocent. But in the strict letter of the law, he's guilty. Without giving away too much of the plot, this is a man who is a school teacher. He's lost his job as part of the downsizing of teachers that happened in a sort of epidemic in Australia. And he's obsessed with his college sweetheart because at the time that they were a couple, it was practically the highlight of his life. Everything seemed to be going well, and nothing has gone too well after that. And he fixates on her, and he runs into her by chance, and he sees that she has a small son, and he starts to do research, or really stalking, and he takes matters into his own hands, which lead to consequences that affect many people in the book. And, you know, the novel asks various questions, and one of the questions it asks, I hope, is it possible to love or care too much? And it becomes a pathology.
One of the ways in which you pursue that is between Anna, Simon's unrequited love, and her husband, Joe, who ought to be a sympathetic character. After all, he is the father of the son who was kidnapped, taken away. But you never do get much sympathy for this guy.
Well, Joe is the kind of guy that women dread, I think, and they hate to, you know, wake up and realize that they've married someone that turns out to be a guy like Joe. And he's the kind of man that men try, he has instincts that men try to stifle from about the time they're 15 onwards. Certainly by the time they leave college, if they go to college, they're hoping that they've tamed this beast. But the thing about Joe is that he's never really tamed.
Maybe you could give us an example of that. There's a scene, not too far into the book, that kind of defines the kind of man Joe is.
Sure. Do I want a coffee? I want a coffee or a juice. I wish someone would tell me. There's a place on Chapel Street with incredible waitresses. One of the guys at work was talking about it. What was it called? I'm too old for the music they play here. Christ, it's not even music. But once you're here, you can't ask them to turn it down. You're lucky if they serve you after that. You're paying for it, for everything. Can I help you, sir? The waitress asks. I don't know if this is the place they were talking about at work, but if it isn't, I might start talking about it. She can't be more than 15. Already so nasty, even if she offers to help me. Every year they bring out a new model. I'm depreciating. Done too many miles. It's unfair. Yeah, she could help me. What juice seems to hit the spot today? I ask her with a smile. I hear myself ask that question. It doesn't actually make sense. It doesn't mean anything except that I've already begun rehearsing. I've begun rehearsing for a role as one of those middle-aged assholes who saunter into trendy coffee shops and cafes alone on weekends, wearing veined brown leather jackets, with a recalcitrant newspaper tucked under one arm and ostentatious car keys tossed and caught in the other hand, calling too loudly to a girl, "What juice seems to hit the spot today?" which doesn't actually mean anything. Does she think that I can't see what's ahead of me? She makes no suggestions. She reels off the juice list from the blackboard menu on the wall. I could have done that. Doesn't she want a tip? Doesn't she know how it's meant to go? And she'll wonder why I pay for it. She'll feign outrage to hear that I pay for it. I have to pay for it. Oh, excuse me. Could you put some ginger and lemongrass in with that? Damn right, it's not a problem. She's gone. She's away, clearing another man's table. He's about her age, or certainly closer to it than I am. Closer to it than I ever was. He's unshaven. I find him ugly. She doesn't. Actually, he repulses me. But not her. What does he drive? What does he make? What can a man so young possibly make that he can sit here and get at a smile like that? Sit here without a trace of panic? He'll have to pay for it one day. Sure as hell. I can't hear what they're saying. I can't understand what they're saying. She can tell that I pay for it. What can she tell?
It's funny listening to Joe, isn't it? You hear him say things and think things that, well, as you say, every man stopped trying to think at the age of 15.
Look, it's true. I've tried to describe this to women, actually. It's a terrible thing, but it's almost a biological thing. And any man that claims he's never felt this way is probably not being honest. I'm talking now about heterosexual men. But you can walk into a building and there are two female receptionists and they are going to buzz you into another office. And you walk up to them and they're both engaged in something, a telephone call, but one is clearly more attractive than the other. And the man will hope that the more attractive one is going to serve him. Now, this is insane because his interaction with the woman will be maybe 10 seconds. And, you know, unless he's some kind of monster, you know, he's not going to engage her. He's not going to try and flirt with her. He's there on some kind of business or for some other reason, or maybe it's a dental appointment. But he wants the more attractive of the two women to be the one to say, please take a seat. And this is ridiculous. But Joe acts on this sort of thing. He will find the more attractive of the two, and despite being married, he'll try to see her, or he'll even try to extend the conversation, you know, for another 90 seconds. It's quite pathetic, but it's something, I think, inherent in male behavior.
It's Elliot Perlman talking about his novel, Seven Types of Ambiguity. Perlman lives in Australia, where he practices law and writes books.